We're going to square off with one of the basic questions that every human being asks at some point or another. The question of, what is the meaning of life? I had a chance several years ago to teach some seventh graders for a day. And when I spoke to them, one of the questions I asked them was, how many of you have asked the question, what is the meaning of life? Why am I here? And to my surprise, almost all of the students in seventh grade raised their hand and said they had already asked that question. So it's the kind of question that's so fundamental that it occurs to us very early at the age of the dawn of reason, basically, we begin asking this question. I think we've reached a point in our cultural situation where a lot of people have given up on expecting to find an answer, or they have found an answer that, we'll talk about it, is highly subjective. And what we want to do tonight is explore the various ways that the question could be answered. So, we could do a very simple sort of starting point, and we could say, the question is there a meaning to life? Is there a meaning to life? And if we think about it, basically there's two different ways, most fundamentally, there's two different ways you could answer the question, and two different ways philosophers have answered the question. One way you could go is to say, there is no meaning to life. It just doesn't, it's not real. There's no ultimate answer to the ultimate question. So there is no meaning to life. Okay, so that's one possible answer. And obviously, if you think of the principle of non-contradiction and go the other way, another way you can go is to say there is a meaning to life. Now, please note that I'm formulating these answers very realistically or objectively. There is or there is not. I'm not talking about what we think, what we believe. We'll get to that, okay? There is a meaning to life. Okay, so those are the two basic ways we can go. Now, I'm quite well aware that there's lots of distinctions to draw, lots of qualifications to make, a lot of ambiguities. That's the way things work in philosophy, is you start out with something very general, and you try to get more specific, more nuanced, more distinctions, more qualifications as you go. But we have to start with general and make our way towards the specific. Okay, so let's start with this one at the bottom, because in a certain sense, it's easier. It's just total despair, quitting the question, giving up, basically denying that there is a meaning to life. There is a name for this position in philosophy. It's called nihilism, which comes from the Latin word nihil, which is the word for nothing. There's nothing. Life is about nothing. It's not going anywhere. It's not for anything. It's just nothing. Could we get a more specific definition of nihilism? Yes, we can. There's a great description of it from John Paul II, the philosopher pope. In his encyclical letter, Fides et Ratio, which is his account of faith and reason and the relationship between them, he gives a definition of nihilism that goes like this. After he describes the history of philosophy, the history of the development of Western thought since the early modern era, he describes the rise of an extreme confidence in human reason, an excessive confidence, perhaps, in human reason, maybe not perhaps. In certain philosophers, it's quite ambitious. The way that reason can solve all problems, it can perfect life as we know it, if we just use our reason. And the rise of modern science gave philosophers and others a great deal of confidence, exaggerated confidence in human reason. Well, when that exaggerated confidence comes when its consequences play out over several centuries, we arrive at this position called nihilism. And here's how he describes it. As a result of the crisis of rationalism, he has the 20th century, and the history of the 20th century in mind, what has appeared finally is nihilism. As a philosophy of nothingness, it has a certain attraction for people of our time. Its adherents claim that the search is an end in itself. You just keep on searching and searching and searching. Life is a journey. You just keep journeying and searching and searching, but you never come to an answer. You never come to an end. You never come to a meaning or a purpose. You just, it's, the search is for its own sake, and that's all it ever is, just a question mark. As a philosophy of nothingness, it has a certain attraction for people of our time. Its adherents claim that the search is an end in itself, without any hope or possibility of ever attaining the goal of truth. In the nihilist interpretation, life is no more than an occasion for sensations and experiences in which the ephemeral has a pride of place. The self is always being transformed. What my life was about yesterday will not be what it's about tomorrow. I'll be someone different, never the same. Same with the universe itself, if we can even say anything about it. Always recreating the self, because there's no self to create, I guess you could say, to begin with, no self to begin with. Nihilism is at the root of the widespread mentality which claims that a definitive commitment should no longer be made, because everything is fleeting and provisional. That's his description of nihilism. Life is basically a stream of consciousness, a stream of sensations and feelings. We can ask questions, ultimate questions, but we can't answer the ultimate questions. We just keep searching, coming up with new answers all the time, and basically all those answers are fallible, overturnable, and able to be abandoned when a new sensation, feeling, experience, or thought comes along. That's nihilism. There's an Italian philosopher, Vittorio Possenti, who said that this description of nihilism, given by John Paul II, was actually the best description he'd ever read anywhere of what nihilism is. Who are nihilists? Are there any historically? Well, we could point to the mid-20th century French existentialist philosopher Sartre as perhaps the paradigmatic kind of nihilist. You just, there's ultimately no final end, no goal, no point at all. There's just life that we're thrown into, and we live it as we can. There's other philosophers of the 20th century that we could put in this category, but it would be controversial. So that's the position of nihilism. Now, what can we say about nihilism? Instead of coming out and giving arguments against it, you know, to try to prove that it's false, I'm going to take another approach, because some philosophers have pointed out there's no point in trying to refute nihilism with arguments or reasons, because nihilism is not the sort of thing that you prove to begin with. It's more of a bold assertion based on the non-principles of life. There are no principles, bases, foundations. It's kind of a raw assertion at the end of the day. So how do you refute or disprove it? So there's another way we can go, which instead of trying to refute it or disprove it, let's try to comment on some of its consequences. And here I want to comment on what we might call its psychological consequences, spiritual consequences, the effects of being a nihilist. I mean, what if someone were to really buy nihilism? Completely. And say there's just nothing. Life is just about nothing. That's a position that some people have considered. Like, what really happens if you buy that or go in that direction? And there was this great psychologist of the 20th century who devoted really his entire life of psychological research and theory and clinical theory and clinical practice, we should say, in terms of his theory, to the question of meaning. Surely you've heard of the psychologist named Viktor Frankl, a fascinating figure to study. German Jew living throughout the course of the 20th century. He died in 1997. He's known for a type of therapy that is now widely practiced and received as a standard mode of therapy in clinical psychology called logotherapy. And basically, the whole point, all of logotherapy comes down to one particular claim. Human beings need meaning in order to be psychologically sound, balanced, and healthy. And if we don't have meaning in our lives, we can't be psychologically sound, healthy, or balanced. And in fact, psychological disorders all are rooted in some way or another in a lack or crisis or problem of the meaning of life. And so logotherapy consists, in a nutshell, of helping people to search for and find the meaning of their lives. Viktor Frankl spent his entire life developing this understanding of our human psychological health and well-being. And it's not only that he did it individually, it spawned an entire school of research. I just read today that there are now over 600 publications, I take it that means journal articles or books, that empirically confirm and corroborate the entire sort of psychological theory that he develops, the human need for meaning. And there are about 80 institutes throughout the world that form or train clinicians to offer treatment for people in the school of Viktor Frankl, the school of logotherapy. So it's a serious, legitimate school of thought and school of clinical practice. Human beings need meaning. Without it, we become psychologically undone. The interesting thing about Viktor Frankl is that he began to develop his theories before the Second World War broke out. But then during the Second World War, he was captured and was imprisoned, and he spent some time in Auschwitz, actually. And he had experience of the extreme rigors that prisoners were subjected to in Auschwitz. And he actually started to write a book while he was there on the what he could see was this crisis of meaning all around him. And there came a point where he describes in a book that became very famous, Man's Search for Meaning. He describes what he and his fellow prisoners were enduring. And it's kind of some brutal scenes in the book where they're describing the horrible things that were happening all around them. I want to spare you the details because they're rather gruesome. But there's a point where a group of prisoners are walking along together, and one of the prisoners mentions his wife and how he was thinking about his wife. And all of the other prisoners that were kind of moving together in this group, they began to think about their wives as well. And Viktor Frankl himself began to think about his wife. And he had this profound experience. He couldn't shake the thought of his wife as he's going along in this labor group or whatever it was they were doing. And there comes a point in the story where he says he couldn't shake this thought of his wife. The picture of her kept flashing before his eyes, and he kept seeing her and in a way knowing her love and contemplating and beholding her love. And then he writes this: "A thought transfixed me for the first time in my life. I saw the truth as it is set into song by so many poets, proclaimed as the final wisdom by so many thinkers. The truth that love is the ultimate and highest goal to which man can aspire. Then I grasped the meaning of the greatest secret that human poetry and human thought and belief have to impart. The salvation of man is through love and in love. I understood how a man who has nothing left in this world still may know bliss, be it only for a brief moment, in the contemplation of his beloved. In a position of utter desolation, when man cannot express himself in positive action, When his only achievement may consist in enduring his sufferings in the right way, in an honorable way, in such a position, man can, through the loving contemplation of the image he carries of his beloved, achieve fulfillment. For the first time in my life, I was able to understand the meaning of the words, "The angels are lost in perpetual contemplation of an infinite glory." That's a very powerful passage. He was able to discover, not by an abstract process of philosophical reasoning, nor by saying, you know, God said so, but by a kind of raw experience of like when life has been stripped of its accoutrements, of its accessories, and human beings are reduced to the barest, rawest terms, like if you're a prisoner in a concentration camp, he's able to discover by a kind of primordial insight, life does have meaning. And the meaning of life is to know love, or as he put it, contemplation of the beloved. That's very powerful. Because it's not simply a religious claim, even though it has clearly has religious implications. It's a statement about human life, human nature, the human person, human being, that's discovered through raw experience, a kind of unshakable conviction. But that unshakable conviction coincides, as he himself notes, with some of the great philosophers down through history, down through time, St. Augustine, St. Thomas, Plato. Okay. Interestingly enough, a few decades after he writes that, John Paul II becomes Pope, the philosopher Pope, and here's what he writes in his first encyclical as Pope, Redemptor Hominis. John Paul II writes, "Man cannot live without love. He remains a being that is incomprehensible for himself. His life is senseless if love is not revealed to him. If he does not encounter love, if he does not experience it and make it his own, if he does not participate in it intimately." Sounds almost exactly like Viktor Frankl. There is a meaning to life. So says Viktor Frankl, so says St. Augustine, so says St. Thomas Aquinas, says John Paul II. And they, at least so far, we've been able to see that it has something to do with love and contemplation of the beloved. So, Viktor Frankl will say, what happens if someone gives themselves to nihilism? They're not going to look for the meaning of life or find it. Know it? What's going to happen? There's going to be psychological disintegration. Here's what he writes in a paper in 1972 that's published in the American Journal of Psychoanalysis. Here's what he writes. "Today more than ever before," and this is in 1972, "the psychiatrist is called upon to treat patients who complain of a sense of futility and emptiness, a feeling of meaninglessness, which I describe as an existential vacuum. There can be no doubt that the existential vacuum is increasing and spreading. In a recent study of 500 youngsters in Vienna," and this was 1972, "it was shown that the percentage of those suffering from it has increased within the last 2 years from 30% to 80%. Even in Africa, the existential vacuum is spreading, particularly among academic youth." After he wrote his book, Man's Search for Meaning, he was invited to the United States for many speaking tours and guest lectureships in the United States at various prestigious institutions. Harvard had him on the faculty for a while and other places. Here's what he says about this. So he has something to say about American students in particular. But he asks, how is this existential vacuum to be explained? Unlike the animal, man is no longer told by his instincts as to what he must do. And in contrast to former times, he's no longer told by traditions and values what he should do. Okay? So he goes on, and here's where he says, here's another effect of the existential vacuum, neuroticism. The existential vacuum is not a neurosis in the strictly clinical sense, if it is a neurosis, it would have to be diagnosed as a sociogenic neurosis, he says. There are, however, cases in which the existential vacuum eventuates in clinical symptomatology. Such patients are suffering from what the author has called noogenic neurosis. And he goes on to explain some of that. And he goes on to talk about how the existential vacuum is not a neurosis. A statistical survey recently showed that among the writer's European students, 25% had this experience, this existential vacuum. And among his American students, it was 60%. The fact that the existential vacuum is more noticeable in America than in Europe is due, and it's very important to hear this as students of science, it's due to the exposition of the average American student to indoctrination along reductionist lines. What does that mean? When Viktor Frankl was touring the United States, he could see that American students are basically taught in their textbooks and in their lectures, and often from an early age, that reality, the world, is nothing but matter. The world is nothing but matter, space-time, and what? Forces. That'd be putting it in a nutshell. A kind of reductionist view of the world. Notice the expression, nothing but. We reduce all things that are to just matter, space, time, and forces. Whatever the fundamental forces are, whatever the fundamental particles are, fundamental material unit. What's missing from that universe? What's missing from that universe is purpose. Things don't have goals. Things don't have a point. What's the point of gravity? What's the point of an atom? What's the goal of these things? They don't have goals, they don't have points, they don't have purpose. It's a world of purposeless. It's a purposeless world. Not just as a whole, but each thing in it. That will cause clinical symptomatology, if you believe it. That's what Viktor Frankl claims. Okay? It's bad for human beings. It's bad for human beings. And he develops this whole form of logotherapy to help people deal with the crisis of meaning that comes from being raised on this and habituated to thinking that. Okay, I say that that's of particular importance to students at, say, Johns Hopkins, because as students of the sciences, that particular claim is always tempting. It's always right there, saying, "Yeah, at the end of the day, maybe it's all just matter, space, time, and forces." So, we need to, as it were, find the alternative. There is a meaning to life. Now let's contemplate that and consider that. When it comes to this claim, there's two ways we can go. There's another distinction we can draw. There's a lot of people that will say, yeah, sure, I grant there's a meaning to life. But it's not so much because the world is this, because it's this, you know, it's just a swirl of matter, space, time, and forces with no purpose inherent in it, with no inherent goals or point of anything. Still, there can be a kind of meaning in this world, but it's what we could call projected meaning. So there is a meaning to life, but it's projected. It's generated out of us. It's our the meaning of life is whatever you subjectively intend it to be for you. See, even in this world, a reductionist sort of world, we can still produce intentions out of ourselves. And this is what I'm going to live for. And that can be your meaning. You come up with your project. So it's a kind of psychological project out of your own, psychologically generated life project. We can all come up with those. Okay? So the meaning of life, yeah, there is one, but it's projected. It comes from you. You have your meaning, you have your meaning, you have your meaning, your life, etc. Have you ever heard the expression, there's a popular saying, the purpose of life is to give life purpose? Yeah, that's the projectionist account of the meaning of life. Okay? I had a professor in graduate school who basically held this, because he was an agnostic. That'd be the fair way to describe his position. He was an agnostic. And students would often object to him and say, well, but if there's no God, then what's the meaning of life? I mean, life just doesn't have any meaning. And his response was, well, what do you mean? Of course it does. You know, my life, I don't believe in God, but my life has meaning. Each summer I have my classes, I have my students and teach my classes. And each summer I go out to California with my wife and, you know, we go to the beach and drink wine and overlook the ocean. And every once in a while I paint pictures and I like to paint, you know, a little bit of a budding artist. And it was an enjoyable summer. Restful, come back, start teaching again. That's the meaning of my life. That's my life project. Now, has he answered the question, what's the meaning of life? Well, in one sense, yes, and in another sense, no. In one sense, yes, he's basically said, I can always project an intention out there into a basically meaningless universe. And come, I can generate a life project and just live for that, and that's enough for me. Okay. What are some difficulties? Difficulties is if once you start to scratch the surface of that, after a while it doesn't seem to be all that much different from nihilism. It doesn't seem to be all that much different. In other words, a merely projected meaning, one that we simply generate out of ourselves like an author generating a fiction, a work of fiction, that kind of life project, is that really any different from the merely ephemeral kind of ever-transformable self that you can just... After all, you can change your life project. You know, any time, can't you? So, it's entirely up to you. There are others who believe this projection theory of meaning. Serious people. Supreme Court justices. I'll read to you a case... Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992. A very famous passage composed by Justice Anthony Kennedy. Here's what he writes in his brief on a case that came before the Supreme Court. So this, what he's writing here now has something like the force of law, or at least part of American jurisprudential tradition now. Listen to what he says. These matters, involving the most intimate and personal choices a person may make in a lifetime, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy, are central to the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. And here's the important claim. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. That's astonishing. That's an astonishing claim. And many, many lawyers have looked at that and said, wait a second, what did you just say? Human beings have the right to define their own concept of existence. You can project whatever you want. They have the right to define their own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Okay? That really sounds like he's saying that human beings are basically, we're all in this like projection game. You project your meaning of life, I project my meaning of life, and that's the way human life is. We just go around generating meaning out of ourselves. And you have a right to generate your meaning, I have a right to generate my meaning, and not just meaning, but definition of the universe. So you say the universe is all just matters and particles. You say there's no God. I say there is. And that's just, it's all just generated one way or the other. It sounds like the projectionist account of meaning has been inscribed in law or endorsed or established in law. And that has a lot of people very worried. Not only have constitutional lawyers told us that approach tends to undermine the rule of law itself, But from a philosophical point of view, there's serious questions as to whether it's coherent. Could it even make sense? So, this is a view of the meaning of life that real people hold. Popular sayings, the purpose of life is to give life purpose. Professors, agnostic professors, who say the purpose of their life is just to carry out their life project, and Supreme Court justices. So, are you starting, when you hear all that, I don't know, how do you react? Do you sense an existential vacuum, like Viktor Frankl talks about? If you do sense the existential vacuum, then maybe that tells you there's something profound in your human nature that's not being met or that's being violated in some way. Okay? What could that be? The other account of the meaning of life is that life has a transcendent meaning. Meaning something like this. The meaning of life, whatever it is something that exists or is real prior to and independently of our choices, life projects, etc. Reality is a certain way in itself. The reality of human beings is a certain way in itself. And there's another sense of transcendent. Not only does it transcend you and your own psychology or me and my psychology and my subjective thoughts, beliefs, wishes, intentions, and projects, but it could even transcend the entire natural order. Like if you think God is the meaning of life. Okay? So what can we say about this sense of the transcendent meaning of life? What do we say about Viktor Frankl? It's hard to say about him. It seems like when he says that the meaning of life is love, he wants to say something like that's what human beings need, that's the purpose, that's the meaning, and that's not projected. It's not something we make up and sort of impose on the world that's basically meaningless in itself. No. The very nature of reality itself is such that love is the meaning of human life, or the contemplation of the beloved. So in that sense, he seems to belong in this school of thought. There is a transcendent meaning in the sense that there's a meaning beyond our own psychological projections, intentions, and projects. But Viktor Frankl, at least in the passage I read there earlier, doesn't seem to take a position on whether that love is a human love, like a friendship, like a spouse or a family, or a love that transcends all of nature, that's not finite but would be infinite. Okay. That's where St. Thomas and St. Augustine come in. When they want to talk about the meaning of life or the purpose of life, they definitely have the sense that the purpose of life, its meaning, is transcendent. Meaning it not only transcends our own psychology, but it also transcends the entire created order. If we wanted to give an account of the meaning of life for St. Augustine, for St. Thomas Aquinas, it's a very simple picture that we can draw, has been drawn on blackboards for a long time. It looks like this. You have God, and God, you could say, creates or gives being to human beings. Human beings made in the image and likeness of God. And when God creates us, he creates us for a purpose. And the purpose is to return to God, to go back to God, to know him and love him by free choice. The contemplation of the beloved, not only a human spouse, but God as the ultimate beloved to contemplate eternally. That would be the meaning of life for St. Augustine, St. Thomas. Where do they get this? How do they understand this? Well, they get it principally from Scripture. There's no doubt about that. The Bible has some marvelous verses that basically assert this very thing, sometimes called the exitus reditus schema, meaning there's an exit, a going forth from God of creatures, and reditus, a return to creatures. It's affirmed in Scripture a couple of times. In the letter to the Romans, chapter 11, verse 36. For from him, and through him, and for him are all things. Revelation, chapter 22, verse 13. The last chapter of the Bible. It sums up. What's it all about? We've gone through all this Bible. Now we're at the very end. What's the point? It quotes Jesus saying, I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And each year at the Easter Vigil, when we bless the Paschal candle, we recite that very verse. That's the exitus reditus schema in scriptural terms. You can also see it, guess where else? In the first chapter of the Bible. What's the first verse of the Bible? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's this side. But scriptural exegetes will also tell you that one of the main points of the opening chapter of the Bible, with its grand review of the days of creation, the main point theologically is to tell you that God created the world for the sake of the Sabbath worship of God. It all climaxes on the seventh day, the Sabbath, which is the day of worship. In other words, the point is to tell you God created the world to be a temple for worship, for purposes of worshiping God. So God's the point, to give him praise, glory, honor, adoration. It all comes from him, and it's all for him. That would be a truly transcendent account of the meaning of life. The schema is what it is, prior to and independently of our psychological dispositions. In other words, the way that St. Thomas and St. Augustine understand it is that this is the essential structure of life, whether you like it or not. That's just your very nature, my very nature. We are essentially from and for God, and we can't be anything other than that. The great question is, what are you and I going to do in terms of the return? How will we use the freedom that we've been given and are continually given by God? Will we use the freedom that we have been given by God for God's sake? Will we choose our way towards a life of knowing and loving God? Will we accept him as our beloved? Will we seek his face? Will we seek to know him and love him and have life with him? Or will we say, you know what? This is all nonsense. Either there is no meaning to life at all, in which case we're back to the beginning, or you just make up your own and you come up with a different life project. Here's the thing. If this is correct, if this exitus reditus scheme is correct, then we were made by God, for God. That's the meaning of life. And if that's true, then we should expect when people, how shall I put it, turn against that or reject that or don't cooperate with that or don't go along with that, what should we expect? We should expect psychological disintegration, which is what Viktor Frankl tells us happens. In ancient Greece, in Greek, the word for meaning is logos. That's where we get the expression logotherapy, meaning therapy. You and I were made by the logos, for the logos. That's why if we don't have the logos, if we don't have meaning, we fall apart. We become dissociated, disintegrated, symptomatic, clinically. Because we're made for the logos. Made for meaning. If we're not made for meaning, if that's not part of our nature, if this is not the essential structure of reality, then why is it that when we don't have meaning, when we start to move more and more and more in this direction, we fall apart? We become disintegrated.
Why is that?
If this is not the essential structure of the world and the meaning of our lives. One last point that I'll make, then we can have some time for Q&A, which is always where we can really get into it. A lot of people have a problem with this. Sartre, as I mentioned earlier, as a kind of example of nihilism, has a real problem with this. Because this position that the world just has a transcendent meaning that is what it is, that doesn't take into account my free input into the world. See, there's a sense in which the meaning of my life is up to me. And I am my own author, in a way. I mean, I can write the story of my life one way. I can write the story of my life another. You can go to medical school, your life can go one way. You can choose to go to law school, and your life goes a very different way. Or you can choose not to go to school at all, and your life will go in a different way still. So the course of our lives seems evidently to be determined by our freedom, by our free choice. And so it becomes clear that who we become in the end is, in a very serious way, up to us. How do we account for that? The only way to account for that, Sartre thought, was deny that God exists, deny that this scheme exists, and you say your life is just what you make it to be, period. Which seems to get you back either to a projectionist theory of meaning or a nihilist one. But St. Thomas and St. Augustine have a great way of answering that, marvelous way. They'll say, we have to distinguish, when it comes to the meaning of life, the primary meaning and the secondary meaning. Primarily, the meaning of life is God. Secondarily, though, your life becomes what you choose. And you can choose to live your life for God, in which case you're choosing to live life for the truth, and to love God and love the truth, or you can choose against that. You can turn away. You can run away. And you can go in the direction of Sartre and others. And yes, your life will become something very different. The meaning of life remains the same, but your life falls apart, disintegrates, okay? Goes in the direction that Viktor Frankl diagnoses. So, the schema that St. Augustine and St. Thomas give us is one that's quite open to acknowledging that our freedom makes a huge difference. And our freedom can be used in accord with the way that the reality actually is. You could use your freedom, which you received from God, in order to go back to God. Or you and I can use our freedom to just turn away and reject God altogether. You can do that. That's not what life is for, but that's how the gift of your life could be abused, thrown away, wasted. That can happen. So yes, things are at stake. Freedom does make a difference. The question is whether we want to live our freedom in accord with the meaning of life or against the meaning of life. But the meaning of life is God, primarily. And knowing Him and loving Him and having love revealed to us by Him. In the end, okay? So, that's a picture, an account of, we could say, the basic contours of the discussion of the whole question of the meaning of life. No matter how far you go into the question of the meaning of life, it is going to come back to these two basic things. And then there's more distinctions we could draw as we go. But those are the basic contours. And I wanted to give those to you, so that you can have them and spend the rest of your life pondering the meaning of life in order to live according to the meaning of life. Okay? All right. Very good. So now, shall we open it up to questions? Good. Let's do it. Be not afraid. Okay, go ahead.
In his text, Tradition and Incarnation, William Portier, Dr. Portier states that when we ask the great questions, as you did of the seventh graders, what is the meaning of life? What is the ultimate meaning of life?
Yep.
We fall short of the ultimate meaning. We're not talking about these little meanings that build up to it, but that actual ultimate meaning.
The ultimate one, right. Because we can have a sense, let's talk, that's a good distinction between what we call particular meanings or lower level meanings. So the meaning of my life is to get up, go to work, support family, do this. But you can still ask one question. Well, what's the point of that? And then flourish and have life together with one another. Okay, well, what's the point of that? And then you keep going down the line until you say, well, what's the ultimate point of all of it? That would be a way of proceeding with the question. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you could say about the projectionist is that it says, it tries to take the things that are particular, like job, painting, drinking fine wine, those are good things, and they can be part of the meaning of your life, but they don't seem to have a kind of ultimacy that we're made for.
So it brings us up short.
Yeah, it seems to. And there's a lot of philosophical discussion about that very thing that we can go into. Somebody else had a question.
Yeah. It's a little bit related. So how can we know that the meaning of life is single to everyone? So it's transcendent, and it's like the meaning of life of myself and yourself is like the same.
Right.
Which you would say that the God.
Kind of, but I think your question is very good, and it's a very common question. It's been asked for ages. Augustine has raised it. Some people want to become soldiers. Some people want to become doctors. Some people want to go into politics. So you have your purpose, I have mine, etc. That's where the distinction between what we call the primary meaning and secondary would become very important. So this gives us a map of human beings in general, human nature in general. So all of us ultimately have God as ultimate end, to know Him, to love Him. Now, the question is, what about the route of the return? There's going to be different paths, projects, that people can take up along the way back. Okay? So yeah, some people will spend their human life in the military, some will spend their life in medicine, some will have family, some will go into monasteries, etc. There's different particular routes, okay, that by which one can go back to God. But what's critical is that each of those is measured or measurable by an important question. Will this actually get you back to God? Is it good? Is this a good way to go? Is a good way to live. And it can be measured by the question, will this get you to the end? Okay. Whereas if it's a life of complete injustice or complete opposition to God, denying the existence of God, opposing God, that will not get one to the end. So there can be differences in the secondary kind of meaning that we talked about.
Why would there have to be a primary one? Like if I'm a doctor, my meaning of my life is just to save lives. And
right.
That's it, right?
Yes, I see it. I see what you mean. So the question then is, does God exist or not? Because if God exists, then life, then the structure of reality is one way. If God does not exist, the structure of reality is another way. If God exists, human life means one thing. If God doesn't exist, human life means another. That's the radicality of St. Thomas's position. Prior to, and independently of whether you want to be a doctor, a sailor, a musician, have a family, not, etc. Prior to any of those particular things about you, there's an ultimate question about the ultimate meaning. And that can only be answered by saying, does God exist or not? That would be the first thing. Now, I thought you might go to the next question. Well, how do you know God? Okay. All right, so well, that's a very good, very reasonable way to go. Now, one thing we could do is we could say, okay, there's arguments for the existence. St. Thomas has one set of arguments for the existence of God. St. Augustine has other considerations of his own. The arguments for the existence of God are, you can start to see their significance now. They are very significant philosophically because they're extremely closely connected with the question of meaning. Is there a meaning to life? So you could just make a raw assertion that God exists. You could give arguments for the existence of God. St. Thomas thinks that there is a natural knowledge of the existence of God that's at least vague and implicit that all human beings have. They may not call God by the name of God, but they might speak of the good or goodness. That's how Plato would speak. So arguments for the existence of God, then, would be elaborations upon that more primordial kind of experiential, rational, kind of intuitive, experiential sort of knowledge that we have of the existence of God. But they have an importance philosophically for this very reason, to be able to say, it's not just an arbitrary assertion that God exists. The order of the universe profoundly impresses the human mind, and saying it strongly suggests the existence of God would be underestimated. And that arguments for the existence of God are an attempt to unfold that intuition rigorously. So we could have an entire talk about arguments for the existence of God, lay them out, premise, conclusion. Yes. Now there's another set of arguments going on the other side as well, which we didn't get into. And it's about the nature of goods, right? So we can talk about the insufficiency of finite goods to satisfy. That's another important set of arguments. St. Augustine is very good on that, and St. Thomas takes over his whole way of thinking about it. St. Augustine does these profound meditations. Nothing finite will satisfy. Why? Why do finite things, even when you add them up, they don't ever add up? They never seem to ultimately satisfy. You always need something more. You're always craving something more. Always looking for something more. You can always have more money in the bank. You can always be prettier. You can always be healthier. You can always be more comfortable. You can always have another house. You can always have more and more and more. He's got others, though. Other points. Every created good, every good that's less than God, is passing away. We're all hurling towards death. It's all passing away. And there are some profound kind of meditations we could go through on that. I've seen this. I've done ministry in nursing homes. You get to people talking to them at the end of their life. Say, Father James, once upon a time I had it all. I was a partner in a nice law firm. Had a portfolio in the bank. I had a huge portfolio of money in the bank. Nice house, wife, kids, great neighborhood, friends. And life was so good. You know, we'd get together on the weekends and have parties at the house. Kids would go to school and help them with their homework. My wife would take care of the house. I'd take care of the house outside. She'd take care of things inside. We'd go to the cottage in the summers. Life was good. It was just so good. And now, my wife is dead. My children have grown up and moved away. My portfolio is gone. The firm is closed down. We sold the vacation home. I can't even get myself dressed in the morning. I can't even cut my own food anymore. Why am I still here, Father James? The insufficiency of the finite. It's all passing away. St. Augustine has some good meditations on that.
So Viktor Frankl, in Man's Search for Meaning, he also talks about how prisoners around him, some people were able to find their survival and motivation through like an unfinished manuscript or other projects. So with him also stating that the kind of overarching theme is love, would you not say that every kind of transcendence would be projected differently for the individual, and then also at the same time every kind of projection can be tied back to a transcendent idea?
I think what we'd have to do is get clear on the distinction between a meaning that's projected, or just having an intention or a project that you come up with, versus a response and a reception. I think that for St. Thomas and for St. Augustine, the meaning of life, which is ultimately God, is a gift that's received from the outside. And we respond or are called to live in response to that gift. Whereas on the projection kind of account, you're not so much receiving something from the outside as you're making it up from the inside. And other people or whatever might be, how should I put it, kind of raw material that you use for your life project. Yeah. So we'd have to draw a lot. You got a really good question about drawing subtle distinctions. Because at the end of the day, we can't project a life project without something around us. There's got to be like some kind of reality outside of us. Yeah.
So I guess just to play devil's advocate. You know,
sure.
Growing up as a scientist,
yeah.
You have to imagine that when you say things like, you know, the world is nothing but matter, space, forces.
Yeah.
Life will eventually end.
Yeah.
And everything that we know will cease to exist. And so it kind of sounds like the whole argument against nihilism, the argument for the meaning of life, is that there's some kind of breakdown psychologically. And that doesn't necessarily mean that there is a meaning to life. So I guess I just wonder how.
Right, you can't. I agree. You can't just say.
Well, I guess what I would say is.
Go ahead.
I mean, we've been conditioned as humans for a very long time to think
right.
that there is a purpose to our life, etc. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is.
Right.
And so, how would you respond to something like that?
Could
we just become. Maybe there is no meaning to life, and could we just become comfortable with that idea?
The idea that we could become comfortable with it seems to be one that Viktor Frankl thinks is just not the case. That there's something about us that seems to be wired to search for and look for. But you're raising an important point that's very interesting. If you think of the human being here as, we could say, a subject in the psychological sense, right? A clinical subject. And you've got this desire that's kind of emanating from you. A desire for what? For meaning. Now your whole point is, now notice there's no object there. Okay? What you're saying is, maybe that's just it. There's just a subject with a desire, a craving, an urge, a longing, and that's just because of preceding efficient causes and the evolutionary situation, and we've just been programmed, and maybe it helps our survival or something like that, but there's ultimately no object. There's nothing that satisfies it, corresponds to it, fulfills it, or is the purpose of it. It's basically in vain. That's kind of the point you're making. Now, that is, I basically take it to be, a statement of this. Yeah. That's another way of getting at it, okay? It's a kind of, forget about the object. We don't even know if it's there. We don't even know what this meaning, this craving, it's not there. If you say that, then you're down to here. Or it's not that I'm receiving something from out here, I'm just gonna keep producing some meaningful project in order to like sort of satisfy this. So I guess like I said earlier, I don't think you can start with just Viktor Frankl, like, hey, if we don't find meaning, we break down. Therefore, there's got to be a meaning. I don't know if that the argument's not that simple. Okay, or we have a desire for meaning, therefore there is one. Now, you could make an argument, and some philosophers have. There are principles like nature does nothing in vain. You can try to see how that works out. And if this is a natural desire, it would be very weird if it's in vain. Why? What motive would there be? What would motivate that? So that's an argument one could make. I'm not making that argument tonight. I think what you need is a kind of say, you know what, forget about evolutionary stories and other such stories that you might tell about the history leading up to this and the subjective condition, and let's ask about this right here, the object. Is there a meaning to life? And if so, what is it? Okay? You go one way, I'd say I'm not going to try to refute nihilism. It's just a way one can go, and it has consequences. of disintegration, dissociation. How do you go this way? What you're asking for is you need an argument to go this way. You need a reason to go this way. And that's where this set of arguments matter, this set of arguments matter, and there can be other such considerations that help you make a case for this whole picture. So that would require additional talks to make a case for that whole picture. But that's the significance of the picture, is it's a direct answer to this question. Is there something out there that is an actual object of ultimate love, knowledge, longing, that fulfills the desire for meaning, or fulfills the search for it? But I think you could also make, and I did make a little bit of an argument there, that said, now wait a second, either there's an objective meaning or a transcendent meaning out there or not. If there is a transcendent meaning out there and we're made for it, that would explain why we disintegrate. If there's not, it gets harder to explain why we disintegrate. So there's at least a part of an argument there. Not a complete one, I grant you. Good question. Great question.
So, if the transcendent meaning is the true meaning that we need to strive towards.
Yes.
What would choosing the other paths lead us to?
Going down the path of nihilism would be, well, that's where I brought in this stuff. That's why I started with Viktor Frankl, to show you that that has psychological consequences that are observable and able and are addressed regularly in clinical settings. Okay? So that has consequences. What about going this direction, going this way, that the meaning of life is totally projected? That's a little bit harder. One argument would be that this basically collapses into this, if you scratch the surface enough. I mean, what, after all, at the end of the day, is the difference between saying the meaning of my life is just my project versus there is no transcendent meaning at all, or there is no meaning at all? What would be the difference? It gets hard to say.
So, in the sense that we need to choose a transcendent path because that would help us lead good psychological, that would help us be psychologically healthy?
That seems to be, not only that it would help us to be psychologically healthy, but that it would be a life lived in conformity with the way the world actually is, if this is the way the world actually is. See what I mean? If you and I, and all of us, are in fact created by God, and we're created by God for God, do you want to live in accord with that truth, or do you want to just let yourself say, okay, I can let that go, I'll be happy with an illusion or not knowing that? You know?
If I'm created by God and if I'm moving towards Him,
then
I see no other path where I can go.
Right. So, right.
Even if I don't actively pursue Him, my act of pursuing some other thing, for example, my academics, can be thought of as a spiritual practice, right?
Yes, you can understand it as sort of a means along the way. So the way St. Thomas understands it is that this is going to have many means along the way. Okay? So you can give yourself to some good practice like scientific research, you can give yourself to family life, you can give yourself to these, what we might call, little projects as a way of making the return. Okay. So they're not incompatible. That's what I was calling secondary meaning. But they're placed in a higher perspective. So when you love a spouse for God's sake. When you raise your children, you raise them for God's sake. When you do your scientific research because you want to know God and God's world and God's creation better, and maybe improve God's world in some way. But it's for God. And that is a level of meaning that's altogether missing if He's not in the picture, and that's the basic story. Yeah.
Thank you for that very interesting talk. So it seems that in one sense, even just now, as you mentioned, for God, but the idea of for God seems to also require a fair degree of critical assessment, right? I mean,
For example, how would I ever know that and be confident in myself, in the path to the return?
Yeah.
Like, how could I know, or how could anyone know at any given
right.
moment that they are actually on a path to be gotten? And
right.
Like, I mean, you know, as has been noted by other people, you know, more people have been killed in the name of God than for any other reason in some cases. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that, you know, I mean, I can think of, say, in my line of work and in my research as an anthropologist now, I'm working with Mennonite ministries in Southern Alabama
yep.
prisons, where the prison I work is the site of the execution chamber for the state of Alabama. And, you know, I'm just thinking of some conversations I've had with the state chaplain, who's often very torn about his own role, and the role of, people say, administering the drugs and lethal injection,
mm-hmm.
Who often profess to be deep Christians and have a similar notion, and yet, you know, for a variety of reasons, this is a good job for them. It provides them with benefits. It lets them put food on the table. And so there's a certain imminence and existential reality to the fact that,
yep.
you know, yet they are participating in an execution, something that they steadfastly deny Christians should be doing.
Yeah.
They're not Catholic, but they would adhere to the Catholic position
yeah.
of life is unimpeachable. You know,
sure.
No abortion, no death penalty, that kind of thing. And so, yet they would talk about their lives in terms of trying to live very faithfully to a similar idea of what you're displaying
yes.
out here.
Yes.
And so, how are we confident about the return that we make? And how do we come to a sense of know that, you know, in one sense it might be obvious, but
yeah.
I can think of a lot of situations where, you know, maybe it becomes very difficult
yeah.
in some cases.
So that's a great, great question, and I'm happy you raised it, and it can be raised in different forms, because it becomes pretty clear that human beings, even though we're somehow meant to make a return to God, we are, when we consider ourselves and our total situation honestly, we are seriously inadequate
mm-hmm.
for the task.
So there's a certain allowance for mistake, for...
Yes, that, or you could raise another question, which is, if God's going to get us here, it can't just be that I have to make the return like out of my resources,
mm-hmm.
but that God has to bring me back to himself. And you shift from like an egocentric to a more theocentric way of thinking about it
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, God's going to have to give us what? He's going to have to give us knowledge of himself
mm-hmm.
and including knowledge of ways that will actually lead to him versus ways that will lead away from him. And he's going to have to also somehow energize, strengthen, animate, or activate us so that we can actually choose what knowledge he gives us and turn away from those things that may appeal to us even though they're actually going to lead away from him. And that's basically what divine revelation and the offer of grace is.
So almost the process of submission to...
Yes, obedience.
To
you call it obedience, submission. But the first thing is faith. So in the letter to the Hebrews, it says, whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And St. Thomas Aquinas is quite clear that faith is the foundation of the entire supernatural life, the life of returning to God. Okay, but that's a gift from God that can be opposed, resisted, etc. So again, we're only scratching the surface here. And likewise, God gives moral knowledge. Don't do this, right? Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit adultery, etc. Those things will not get you back to God. They'll lead you away.
Right.
Okay.
It's almost as if you're describing, this is kind of almost the work of faith, is to sort of sift through your own critical reasoning versus a strong sense of obedience to faith.
I would say it's a work of integration, where you bring together what you know by reason
mm-hmm.
with what you've learned by faith.
Mm-hmm.
And there are arguments for the existence of God. We can use our reason to give those arguments. There are arguments for the insufficiency of all finite goods. We can use our reason to give those arguments. And we can get, through philosophical knowledge, an understanding, at least a vague understanding, of this basic picture. Then we do a second kind of reflection and say, okay, yeah, but now how do you make the return? How do you get back? And which is what you're doing. You say, well, there's got to be another story, which is divine revelation. And that completes the picture. There's going to be more to the picture than just that.
So that's just scratching the surface. Okay. Good. Okay. Well, thank you all very much.
Thank you.